This program is brought to you by Fresh FM.
Hello and welcome. I'm Galen Pound and you are listening to Top Writers. My guest today is Amy Hindley. Welcome to Top Writers, Amy.
Good morning, Gayla.
What made you decide to write your autobiography, Not a Leg to Stand On?
Because of my unusual story, I also wanted to dedicate my book to all unwanted children everywhere in the hope that they will persist to do their best in the face of hopelessness, to believe that in the end their spirits will prevail, and to nurture their childhood drama into a source of courage, creativity, and compassion. And I hope this may help many people.
And if you read Amy's book, you'll understand why she's dedicated it to those unwanted children. Now, can you please tell us a little bit about your life, maybe starting at the beginning when you were born?
I was born with spina bifida, and I came into a family that were poor and needy. And so I was, with this disability, it's a terrible challenge for people. So I was put into the state. I became a child of the state. And for the years, I swept into this strange world of medical ethics, hidden away from the outside world, lost between references, specialists, scientists, nurses, obstetricians, orthopedic surgeons, no one taking ultimate responsibility. I'm a case on a record cards of humorous professionals and a great source of irritation to some of them. None even seem to know what to do for the best. Somehow I deluded them all.
Right, now you actually had to fight to have your legs amputated, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
And once they were amputated, which was when you were 18, your artificial legs gave you a new lease of life, didn't they?
Oh, yes. I heard about Bader, and I'd heard about this, that he was given a pair of artificial legs. And so I wanted artificial legs as well. But as a girl of 15, to tell the doctors I wanted an amputation, it just wasn't accepted.
Right. You were known as a troublemaker and difficult to handle. And at times you felt very much like a non-person, didn't you? Because they said because you were crippled, that there was no point in you having an education.
No.
Which makes it even more remarkable that you've written this book. And I had to laugh in the book because the first job you ever had was checking stamps for spelling mistakes.
That's right.
How did you get around that when you couldn't read or write?
Well, you see, the authors would send in the pattern of their stamp and the words would be on it. And so as a proofreader, I had to check that the words that the authors had put on the stamp were correct. So I could follow by using sign and brain. I'm a visual creature, so I could see the signals and I could compare it with the letters. So I could tell the difference between a letter T and a letter S by its shape.
Right. Now, it wasn't until you married Robbie that he helped you learn to read and write. And this is actually, while it should have been a time of happiness for you.
Yes.
His mother, Lady Craven, disinherited him for marrying a cripple,
yes,
which is a politically incorrect term these days.
Yes.
Now, you had no domestic skills, no idea how to run a home or anything.
No.
And there's a passage in your book you'd like to read about Robbie, is there?
Yes. What I wanted to say was that one of the things about being disabled, you don't consider people will want to marry you. And because I had been brought up and had 12 operations and people were prodding and prigging and trying to change me, I didn't know who the hell I was. So you can imagine when this man walks into my life and starts to change it. And because I was by now a hard-faced bitch, I wouldn't let you get close to me because I didn't want to be hurt. But I could sense there was something about this man that troubled me. He comes along, and I must tell you what happened. We'd had a beautiful day out in the country taking photographs, and I thought this may be my last chance of happiness and I'm going to make the most of it. However, when we got back, all this time I'd been going with Robbie for about 6 months, and all this time he never referred to my disability. So I was under this illusion. He didn't realise I was disabled. And then one evening at his flat, we were in his dark room developing photographs. And as the pegs printed on a string to dry, he mentioned casually that he had a friend with a gammy leg too. I came down to earth with a bump, shifting uncomfortably under his perceived scrutiny. Hot tears welled up, and now he's going to break it to me that he doesn't want to see me any longer, and for a couple of minutes I remained stony silence. Then I blurted out, "I suppose you feel sorry for me now. Well, let me tell you, Robin Craven, I don't need your pity." I get up and walk abruptly out of the dark room, down the grand staircase and through the front door. Once in the street again, I head with downcast eyes towards the railway station. Suddenly, Robbie grips me from behind, throws me off balance. He whirls me around and shakes me by the shoulders. I stare up at him. "Feel sorry for you," he explained. "Feel sorry for you? I just love you, and the sooner you marry me, the better." I stand there like a zombie. I can't believe my ears. And then the next day, I'm so convinced that this must have been a dream that I arrange for us to lunch together the next day. I wait until we've been served before I explained my fear that I imagined it all. Did he actually ask me to marry him last night, or had I made it up? Before he was able to form an answer, I blurt out all that troubled me, that with my disability he'd be taking on an awful risk, that I'm not easy to live with and will need lots of attention. Another thing, I don't believe in divorce. Once married, I plan to stay married, and I can't have children, as there's no way I'd risk hanging Spina Bifida down on any child. Also, I long for my own home, not a flat, but a house and have you finished? I don't believe he'd listen to a word I've said. Mortified, I leave the table and stumble outside. Robbie dashes after me, takes my arm and leads me back inside. "I listen to you, Amy. Now you will hear me out. I met you out of the blue and knew you were the one for me, disability and all. I promise to love and to cherish you for the rest of your life, whatever it takes. I'm waiting a long time for someone like you." He paused to allow all this to sink in and then continues. "So, we can't have children. I'm not marrying you to be a childbearing machine. You want your own home. That's only natural, and you shall have one. We're going to the state agent and pick up some brochures after lunch, okay?" "Okay," I echoed. "Now, will you marry me?"
And of course you did. And then unfortunately Robbie died extremely young. Mm. How hard was that book to write? There's a lot of heartache in it.
Yeah. It took me 5 years because there was a lot of thing I didn't want to recall back again. But it had to be done. The truth had to be told. And I was fortunate at the time. I was seeing a psychotherapist who helped me to face up. And I had a very good mentor.
As well as the sad bits, there are some really, really funny bits.
Oh, yes.
And that, like the time that you joined a group to go to Spain.
Yes.
And it turned out to be the Cambridge Walking Group.
Yes.
Would you like to tell us a bit about that time?
Well, I'd always wanted to travel, and I was afraid to travel on my own. And I was a member of our church, and they had a little brochure that used to come out, and there was Cambridge people were advertising people who'd like to go to Spain, and I thought, oh, I'd like this. So I applied, And I got accepted. And remember, they hadn't met me. The first time they met me was at the railway station. But because I was carrying my own suitcase, I don't suppose they noticed I was limping, you see. And we get over there, and horrors of horrors, they found that I was disabled. And they had to have an emergency meeting. And I had to sit outside on the veranda at this little villa we were staying at. And the landlord just happened to come out and wanted to know in his pidgin English, you know, why was I sitting there and everybody in the other room? And I said, oh, they're discussing my case of how to send me back home. I'm not wanted. And he was alarmed, and he goes and he says, but why? Why does no one want you? And I said, well, I'm disabled. I've got no legs, and they want me to go. I was feeling very sorry for myself. But he took this in. Next thing, he flew in the doors, and the next thing, all his relatives started to come out and started to feel my legs to think it was genuine, because they happened to have someone in the house that only got one leg. So they couldn't believe that I had two, and here I was in a foreign land wanting to So, anyway, the next thing I knew, they go barging into the meeting and tell them that they will look after me. What is it they wanted? So, when they said we had to move from place to place, he said, oh, I have plenty of relatives all round. They will look after her. You carry on walking and we will fix transport and everything. So, but the loveliest thing of all, after this man thought it was, gave me a lecture for joining them. He was an out-and-out snob. And I remember lying on the beach once, and I said to him, oh, be a love. Could you fetch me that towel? And he, because I was lying without my legs on, you see, so I couldn't really get up to go and get the towel. So he comes with the towel and he throws it at me. He says, and I'm not your love either.
It's a very, very funny part of the book. Now, I think we need to explain that you were actually born in the UK.
In England, yeah.
Yes. And you came out here when you met a lovely man on the train called James Hindley. And you sold up and made the big move to New Zealand. Now, words are obviously very, very important to you. In one part of the book, you describe yourself as stumping off. When did you realise the power of words and how you could use the right words for the right effect?
Oh, this was the help of the writers group, the romantic writers, you know, because for years people said to me, Amy, you ought to write your book. And I said, oh, I couldn't, mainly because I'm a shocking speller and I can only count on fingers, and once that's gone. I had a knack of getting others to do it for me, and this obviously made me better off than I was. And the book would never have been written if it wasn't for Sally Ash. Sally was my mentor, and she didn't laugh at me at my awkwardness. She just encouraged me. She said, just write, and then say it as it comes. And then she used to have a lovely way, if things weren't quite right, by saying, ooh, we're girding the lily. Ooh, we're egging the pudding. Oh, and then she'd give a yawn and say, oh, I think all your readers have gone to sleep. So we had to shorten it. So from 500 pages right down to just over 237 pages. So, but he's got it all in, what I've been trying to say, because I do waffle on. And secondly, because of my upbringing and the way I was brought up, I had to repeat everything because I wasn't sure you were listening to me. So you would find that I would do this, repeat myself. It's a very bad habit. But when I went under psychotherapy to try and help me to accept Amy, because I hated her, she was disabled, she was no good, she was a failure, she was, you name it, she was it. And every time I tried to be successful, someone would come and click my wings. And even death cheated me out of my husbands, who were very good to me. But still, it's better to love and lost than not to have loved at all. That's my attitude. And since then, words have been magic to me. And looking back, I've noticed I always ended up in jobs where books were written. It was most odd. Or you were required to do corrections or something. I'm looking back now, but I hadn't thought of it at the time. I would end up in jobs like that, you know.
No. Now, interdependent is a word you use a lot. Mm. Can you
please explain its relevance to your life?
Very much so. You know, today I think a lot of disabled people are in denial. We are told we are independent. We can become independent. I'm sorry, it's an illusion. We can become interdependent, meaning I need you, you need me, and together we can make an exciting life. I realized one of the things I had to accept in life was that I am permanently disabled. No amount of money is going to correct it. No amount of wishful thinking is going to alter it. So I had to learn to live with my disability. So I said, okay, here's the challenge. If I'm told I'm interdependent, then I will get all the help that's required, and that has happened, and what a difference it's made to my life. I do not want a handout, I want a hand up. And so once people understand to get rid of that word independent, they felt that they could help me. But while I carried that word, people said, oh, you never know you were disabled. And I thought, my God, this is why I can't get help. Because if you don't see me as disabled, you can't help me, can you? You know? So I thought, no, that had to go. And it's magic.
So these days, does your disability define Amy, or does Amy define her disability?
Amy defines her disability. I am Amy. And you can call me what you like. If you think I'm a cripple, to you, I'm a cripple. To someone else, I'm a remarkable person, you know? So I've discovered it wasn't till I wrote the book, and then when I read the book, that I saw the spirit of this woman I had lived with for years and didn't even know her. And it suddenly changed my whole life into something different. I'm going to be me now.
Great. Now, the song you have chosen today is She by Charles Aznavour. Can you tell us why, please?
I think you've only got to listen to his words and you'll see me in it.
Right, let's have a listen to She.
She may be the face I can't forget, a trace of pleasure or regret, maybe my treasure or the price I have to pay. She may be the song that summer sings, maybe the chill that autumn brings, maybe 100 different things within the measure of a day. She may be the beauty or the beast, may be the famine or the feast, may turn each day into a heaven or a hell. She may be the mirror of my dream, a smile reflected in a stream. She may not be what she may seem inside her shell. She always seems so happy in a crowd, whose eyes can be so private and so proud. No one's allowed to see them when they cry. She may be the love that cannot hope to last, may come to me from shadows of the past that I remember till the day I die. She may be the reason I survive, the why and wherefore I'm alive, the one I'll care for through the rough and ready years. Me, I'll take her laughter and her tears and make them all my souvenirs. For where she goes, I've got to be. The meaning of my life is she. She.
Mm. thank you so much for being with us today. You are definitely an inspiration, not a failure. Now, your book, Not a Leg to Stand On, is published by the Copy Press and available from their offices. I'm Galen Pound, and you've been listening to Top Writers. A podcast of this program and upcoming events can be found on www.topwriters.co.nz.
Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this program available through funding the Access Internet Radio Project. Cheers, New Zealand On Air.